Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, your host. It's been 100 years since the Spanish flu killed millions worldwide. And while we've made great technological progress in the years since, we still remain vulnerable. Greater mobility, population pressures, and climate change create high-risk conditions for the spread of disease. In this week's episode, we'll talk to Peter Piot. He's director of global health at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine and is the author of the book No Time to Lose, A Life in Pursuit of Deadly Viruses. Moderating this program is my co-host, Marcos Kounalakis.
Welcome to everyone this evening and welcome to you, Dr. Peter Piot. We're gathered to talk about global preparedness and innovative prevention in the world of medicine. We'll look at future health threats, and we'll discuss some of the work that you've done. But the title of the event this evening is 100 Years After the Spanish Flu, Are We Ready for the Next Pandemic? So I think before we talk about anything else, maybe we should really do a quick run through what the Spanish flu was. I know that my family was personally affected by it, but I know that my family is not the only one.
Yeah. Well, Marcos, there were like 50 to 100 million people who died from it, actually. And this is 100 years ago, before there was any commercial air travel, and when there were only 1.9 billion people on our planet. Today, we are like 7.5 billion, more or less, and billions of flights per year. So it really affected the you know, the world. It killed more people than World War One, but it really affected the world's GDP. It really, when you look at, it was not only here, but also, for example, in India, in the Pacific, in the South Pacific, you know, like up to 20% of population of islands just disappeared. So it was really bad, and that's the big one. And I think it's time to reflect on that, because one day there will be another big one. We can predict with high certainty that there will be a completely new type of influenza or flu coming up in the next, whatever, 50, 60 years. It's going to happen. When, where, and how, we don't know. And so we need to be prepared.
Right. So the big event, the biggest epidemic of the 20th century was Spanish flu, and now we're just really waiting. Or are we just waiting? I mean, I imagine that there are a number of things that we can do. But let me ask you, you know, if my understanding of flu, which is what you're suggesting is likely to occur in the 21st century in some epidemic level, yeah, is that it really is a crossover type of disease. It comes from animals like birds or from swine or chimpanzee. I guess chimpanzees brought us something else.
No, that's HIV.
That was HIV. But as we urbanize, shouldn't there be less of an opportunity for some of these epidemics to be occurring if we're not really living amongst animals the way that we once were?
Well, there's a kind of paradox. On the one hand, the world has been doing really well against infectious diseases. I mean, there's a decline of most infectious diseases worldwide, even in Africa, where that's still the first cause of death. But people die now more from cardiovascular diseases, diabetes, and so on, you know. But on the other hand, the risk for epidemics, for outbreaks, is increasing. And there are a few reasons for that. First of all, we should know that all of these epidemics, all of them, are so-called zoonosis. What does that mean? It means that they come from animals, from other animals. We are human primates and from others. And the second biggest epidemic of modern times is HIV. And if that continues, it will ultimately kill more people than the Spanish flu. It's just a slower type of epidemic, but it has collectively already killed probably between 35 and 40 million people.
Right.
We think maybe that that's over. No, it's not over. But 1 million people are dying from AIDS every year still. Now, so these are all coming from animals, and we're more people, 7.5 billion on the planet. There's more pressure, demographic pressure on ecosystems. even if indeed, like even in Africa now, half of the population is living in cities, food production has changed, and there's a global chain. This deforestation, people live much closer to where wild animals are. And I would say this mobility that makes the world much more at risk. So the risk is actually increasing.
In fact, my son, I have a couple of teenagers, and they have this game called Plague. Are you familiar with this particular game?
No, that
you
I
must
know.
Look this up. It is really something. What the goal of the game is to infect the world and to eventually destroy it.
Okay.
And of course, you can do things in the game of play. You can decide to ground airplanes,
yeah.
for instance, to
yeah, yeah.
isolate the disease. You can decide to isolate the nation in other
yeah,
ways.
Yeah.
And so there are constant trade-offs that you're making as this plague starts to spread. I recommend it. Anyway, it sounds like what you're saying
yeah.
is that this new mobility, this new urbanization of density of life that we live
yeah.
in.
Food production also.
Yes.
And the globalization of many things means that what used to be a local outbreak today can, in no time, you know, can become global. One example is happened in 2003, yes, in Hong Kong. There was SARS. Also respiratory virus. I'm not so worried about Ebola. I mean, I worked a lot on Ebola, but there you need really close contact in order to be infected. It's close contact with someone with body fluids or with someone Ebola. It's the respiratory things, this stuff you can catch on a bus to say so. And so Hong Kong had quite a big epidemic, which in economic terms, it not only killed people, but also it brought down the GDP of Hong Kong by 4 or 5%.
Right.
Just a stupid virus. And then someone flew from Hong Kong to Toronto. And then, you know, out of there started another outbreak. So that's the world today. Before, you know, it would take, I don't know how long it would have taken you to go from, from Hong Kong to Toronto in 1918, probably
right.
a month or so. But now everything goes much faster.
Right, so the host would either be dead or already symptomatic
yes.
in some way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it is part of our globalized world, and that's the and we'll have to live with it. Talking about the plague, one of my favorite books is called The Plague by Albert Camus, and he describes very interestingly this: the plague is hitting Oran, a city in Algeria. And three phases in how societies react to a plague. The first one is, it's not true. It's not there.
Denial.
And remember, AIDS, that's how it was also. Denial. It can't be true. It's also how it's very human, eh? That when you get really bad news, you wish it weren't true. Second phase is that it's the others. You start blaming, you know, and foreigners, people are different, and so on. And it's only when you go through that, and the third one is about doing something about it. But when you look at the cost of it, you said flights may be canceled and stopped and so on. That's what we saw in Ebola in West Africa in 2014. So countries that were already struggling with logistics, with managing international assistance and so on, they were then faced with the fact that when it came to West Africa, the two airlines that were taking on most of the international flights, British Airways and Air France, they just stopped all flights, making it far more expensive, far more difficult to assist and hitting the economy in addition. So a lot of the cost of these epidemics are not directly caused by, let's say, the virus or the microbe, but by the measures against it that are based on fear and that are honestly usually totally useless.
Right.
We know that when there was SARS in Toronto, Canada installed control for fever and so on, and checking people who came into the country and all that. How many cases did they detect with that at the cost of millions? Zero. Not one single case. And that's usually, you know, that's what the UK did, what the US did, you know. my wife and I, we had gone to Sierra Leone and during the epidemic. And on 20 days after coming back from Sierra Leone, we had to go to Seattle from London. The morning that we wanted to leave, we got a phone call from British Airways saying that we are rerouted, we are not allowed on the plane, and so on. And we had to go to fly via, we had the choice among three airports, JFK, Chicago, and I think Atlanta. Because these were the only ones where they could take temperature and do an interview, you know, for people who came from this dangerous place. And it was totally ridiculous. This is not how you stop an epidemic. And the cost of it is ridiculous. But it gives the impression that you do something. So that's mostly the driver of it.
Right. So we want to get past the impression that we're doing something and actually to the idea that we can do something. And this is a great deal of what your work is about, is how do you actually work in the field of prevention, identification, education, and then, of course, the political realm of how do we then organize the resources of societies, whether it's states themselves or at an international level, to be able to combat these things, because many of these things, I think you suggest, are preventable. In fact, you've written a book called No Time to Lose, A Life in Pursuit of Deadly Viruses.
Advertisement.
Yes, he's holding the book up. But I think a big part of what your work is really focused on is how do we get to the point where we're not just presenting the impression of that we're doing something, but actually getting to the point where we can perhaps not stop the 21st century epidemic from occurring, but prepare to confront it when it's in its early phases.
Yeah, one thing is that, as you said, we can't prevent epidemics to occur, to start outbreak, because as I said, you know, it comes from animals and so on, it will always occur. What we can do, though, is to prevent them from becoming epidemics. And the title of the book has to do with the fact that No Time to Lose is that when it comes to a contagion, to an epidemic, and a communicable diseases, acting early makes all the difference, by definition. Because when you stop the spread of a virus, let's say at the beginning, you're not only preventing the next generation, but also the people who would be infected from the one generation and who would infect others and so on. And the longer you wait, the more expensive, the more complicated it becomes. Mm-hmm. And we still are often behaving as we would set up a fire brigade when the house is on fire.
Right.
Or that we say we should have had safe, construction rules and so on.
Building codes
and so on when the house is collapsing or when there is an earthquake. You need to do that before. So the first and most important part in terms of epidemics is have very good local systems for early diagnosis. That means laboratories, that means people, that means some money, that means a system so that you know. In Ebola, the Ebola epidemic in 2014 in West Africa, it took 3 months between the first case died and the diagnosis. Mm-hmm. 3 months, and that's precious time that is that is wasted, and that if the epidemic or the diagnosis would have made very early on, I think it could have been just brought in. In the very early stages. So we talk a lot about global response and all that, but the most important is the local one. And then and that is also where Skoll, I see Mark sitting there, that's what you're working on with the Skoll, whatever it called, pandemic preparedness or something like that.
Ending pandemics,
yes. Initiative is about, and that's what we also do at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. So helping the most vulnerable countries to put systems in place. But also the question is, can we predict epidemics? Do we know whether one will occur or not?
So what is the answer? Can we predict them?
We can only say what we can predict is who's most vulnerable. Where are the conditions that, it's more likely to occur? And why is that? For example, we know that influenza, as you said, I mean, it's poultry, birds, chickens, chicken markets, and so on. You need to keep a really close eye on what's going on there, because that's where it often starts from. We know that Ebola comes from bats, so we know that certain types of bats, they where they are. So the ecology is very important. It's what we call one health, so that when you deal with health of humans, we not only should look at humans, at us human primates, but right. We also have to know what's going on in the animal world that could be a reservoir. So the local systems and resilience is really the number one, and that's the base. And that's linked then to the status of society sometimes. In West Africa, let's not forget, Sierra Leone and Liberia came out of decades of very brutal civil war.
Yes.
Guinea of years of, very corrupt dictatorship. The result was professionals that left the country and so on. In Liberia, there were 51 registered physicians for the whole country, of about 4.5 million people, and not enough nurses and so on and so on. And how do you expect that with that kind of human resources and that you can face any crisis?
Well, that really brings up this question of, if the locales that are most vulnerable, most susceptible, also don't have the political infrastructure or even the societal cohesion to be able to confront this, how then are we supposed to, as we sit here in San Francisco, make sure that the incubators, if it were, of these potential pandemics, epidemics, how are we supposed to then confront this from an external perspective? Clearly, there must be partly a political solution on the ground to be able to create the conditions that allow for this infrastructure to develop, allow for institutions and trust between the populace and their society and their governance to exist. But as I sit here in San Francisco, I feel rather powerless.
Well, it's what's absolutely true is that dealing with epidemics is imminently a political issue as much as a technical issue. Just pure technical solutions don't exist there. One other example that I'd like to give is a part of the world you know very well, and that is the AIDS in Russia and in the former Soviet republics. It's the one region in the world where the number of new infections of HIV continue to go up in a big way. And that's not because there's no money. That's because of policy failure and the refusal of the government to deal with, drug use, needle exchange. I mean, to apply, evidence-based methods that we know that works. And that's a purely political issue. So what can we do here?
Yes.
What we can do is a few points. One, and that is happening increasingly, is making what's now called global health security, dealing with epidemics, which are a threat to the whole world. That's the difference with the 19th century. As I said, if an outbreak thousands of miles from here is a threat to us here as well because of mobility. So making that part of foreign policy.
Right, so an understanding that, in fact, we are a globalized world, borders really don't matter when it comes to disease.
And there is the U.S., the previous administration, already under the Bush administration, started with a global health security initiative and so on, and where many ambassadors could talk about it.
Yes.
And I think that's the first thing to do. Secondly, is provide support for money, technical support, and so on, to the countries that are the most vulnerable and the least equipped.
But aren't they also the countries that are the most corrupt oftentimes and the ones least likely to be able to apply those resources?
Yeah, although I must say corruption is not the exclusive, exclusive to low-income countries.
Yes, of course not.
But no, that is true. In some countries are among very corrupt countries, and where take Congo, DRC, Democratic Republic of Congo, where we've had several Ebola outbreaks, where there's armed conflict and so on. And what do you do then? But I think the key here is that in order to protect the local population, but the population at large, we have to work, and we can work directly with civil society groups, mm-hmm. And there's always a dialogue. And I think that when it comes to health threats, it's often, not always, but often possible to break through either partisan stuff, like here in U.S. Congress, one of the few issues where the two parties, the eye to eye, is like support for the AIDS program for PEPFAR.
Yes.
Unusual. But also, you can do that with countries. But there are also other initiatives. For example, when it comes to develop new tools, new vaccines. Mm-hmm. After the Ebola outbreak in 2014, when we could test, and our school was very involved in that, test vaccines.
Okay.
And as surgeons would say, asho, during the epidemic, because that's the only way, time you can find out whether something works and protects. And I was in Guinea with a product that came from Merck, and in Sierra Leone with Johnson & Johnson. And we could demonstrate that they protect, that they work. But what is clear is there is no market incentive for any company to develop a vaccine for Ebola, Lassa, and what have you. There's no market. For influenza, yes. For flu, you know, you can make money of it. But not with vaccines against these outbreaks, because they're in poor countries, they're in isolated situations, and so on.
Sure.
So what do we do? And that's where we can also come in here from San Francisco.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about what it is that most animates you these days, what it is that you're personally working on and feel as if it would, that you really are hoping to achieve in your work as you go around the world and as you investigate and analyze epidemics and pandemics.
Well, a few points. First of all, is that we have mechanisms to support on the ground preparedness. I think we are doing better and better on the global mechanisms for vaccines, for early warning, and so on. But what's really needed is better ways of supporting people in the most vulnerable, the poor countries. And that's also most difficult. So that's really very high on my mind. Secondly, there's an epidemic, the biggest of this moment, that's kind of getting forgotten, and that is HIV. Where the, you know, in San Francisco is doing okay. Oakland is doing it's a disaster. If you're a black gay man, I mean, your risk for, getting HIV is incredibly high. So, and we were in KwaZulu-Natal a few weeks ago in South Africa. A young woman has every year a risk of becoming HIV infected of like 4 to 6% per year. By the age of 30, 40% are HIV positive. So it's a bit a victim of our success. So that's on my mind. And thirdly is that I think that, okay, in California is more aware of it than other parts of the world, but we need to start really getting far more serious about climate change and health and how that impacts. It's not just that there will be mosquitoes appearing in parts where there weren't any before, and that we can have epidemics, and we see even on the Côte d'Azur in France, you know, where that we had epidemics of chikungunya and all this. So that's a thing. My last point is that we need to address health in a way that is fully in the spirit of promoting human rights, because a lot of human rights violations are really at the origin of some of our biggest health problems. And that can go from sometimes when we know for HIV, but also gender-based violence, we have humanitarian crisis. So these are the things that are on my mind.
Well, that's
a full plate,
really problematic. I'm not feeling terribly good about that. But, you know, I wanted to touch on that.
I feel good about it because we're working on it, so we're making progress.
Well, good. On the climate change, even though we are having some issues recognizing climate change in the United States at times, one of the things that you mentioned is not just the mosquitoes, but, and I'm not sure if this is the case, is it true that there may be viruses or bodies that can be uncovered as a result of
Yes.
Diseases that have existed in the past that will suddenly be uncovered.
Yeah, that are now in the permafrost.
Yes.
In in your favorite country, in Siberia, and so no, this could happen, absolutely.
Okay, yeah. But you're working on that.
No, on that one, no.
Well, well, thank you for the things you are working on.
Thank you.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Peter Piot. He's Director of Global Health at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and he's the author of the book, No Time to Lose. This program was moderated by my co-host, Marcus Kounoulakis. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.